I will not give you a little neck rub. Welcome to episode 4 of The Aphorists. I'm Jesse Holding with Anthony Ryan, and we are in the dog patch today, recording from our studio again.
It's a sunny, damp, tattered cloud Sunday.
Ooh, beautiful.
It's perfect.
Tattered November. Cloud. Yeah.
November.
Last week was so awesome. I surfed like 3 or 4 days in a row, and it was just like gorgeous. And the rain came, and it all blew out. But it was nice to get out there.
Sounds great.
How's the new cruiser working in the rain?
Oh, this ride?
Yeah.
Jesse's referring to my bicycle. It's good. I literally just put it together yesterday.
Right.
It's funny, when I finally get it together to, like, build up a bike, it's because I have something I want to do, such as meet you at the studio. I'm like, I want my bike for that.
Right.
I want my bike back. It's me raining. I want a bike with fenders.
Nice.
Because my other road bike, I can't use that for every day because it's like, it's my baby. I need to keep it in.
Does that get torn up from riding it around? Probably, huh?
Well, you know.
City riding is tough.
Yeah, and you lock it up, it gets scraped.
Sure.
And, you know, I'm not wanting to treat it with kid gloves. I still intend to ride it.
But, right.
But it's like, that's my recreational bike.
Right. You don't.
And I really, what drove it home is I went for a ride with Ben Meyer, colleague of Irish Smith's upstate a couple weeks ago. We did San Bruno Mountain.
Oh, nice.
To the summit there.
Yeah.
That's a ride that he and I do together. And, you know, it's just like, man, this bike is so awesome.
Nice.
And I actually did a little adjustment to the fit on the bike. Just like moved my seat up.
Mm-hmm.
Made it all the difference, but.
Nice.
Yeah, you know, it's just like a really well-made, like, steel frame.
Mm-hmm.
There's just nothing like it.
I had a sweet Dawes road bike that was a steel frame. It's like an English frame maker.
Mm.
My dad had given me.
One of those, like, lug frames with the.
No, it wasn't lug. It was welded.
Mm-hmm.
But it was so sweet. But, you know, I was a little bit bigger back then, and it didn't. I actually
did you
broke
break it in half.
I didn't break, but I broke the rear wheel stays.
Yeah. Did they break at the bottom bracket?
No, they just broke like halfway, just snapped halfway up. And I was riding and I.
Wait, like, in the middle of the chain stay? Not at a weld?
I'm talking about the one that's like goes from the seat post to the back wheel. Is that the rear wheel stay? Not the one that runs along the crank, but the one that...
I feel like we call that a chainstay. I don't know why.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. But I knew what you meant.
Right, right. Yeah. So it just broke halfway, like between the seat and the brake, where the brake, you know, closer to the seat, just snapped.
And I was broke the weld or broke the...
Broke the...
Wow.
Yeah. Not the weld. It just broke the...
Crazy.
The pipe, whatever.
Tube.
The tube. There you go. And I remember I put in my brakes and I was just kind of like riding. I was riding in Berkeley. I just worked out and, you know, I was just doing like the serpentine you can do on those, you know, just when there's no cars around, you just ride.
Yeah, I see you guys out there.
Yeah, totally.
You're in flip-flops, weren't you?
Yeah, no, I wasn't. And so I grabbed my rear brake and I wanted to stop really hard and like the whole bike like came apart, right? Like the wheel just kind of kept going. And it just flexed. It opened up. And I was like, what?
Mm-hmm.
And I look back and my stomach just dropped because it's like just thinking about an accident with that tube coming back into my leg or something like that.
Such a scary
prospect. So I
took it in cycling though. Like you always know like, yeah, if one thing goes here.
Right. Especially like I would just be bombing down hills on that thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So I took it in and I said, you know, is this normal? And he said, well, look at you. I said, what do you mean, look at me? He's like, you're too big for this bike. You can't ride this bike. How much do you weigh? I was like, I don't know, 240, 230. He's like, yeah, this bike is like...
How much do you weigh now?
185.
Holy crap, you're a big guy.
It was huge. And he's like...
And that was all muscle?
Mostly. There was a fair amount of fat there, too, but...
Give me a reference, like an athlete or celebrity, like a body build. Who would you look like? Hulk Hogan?
No, he was much skinnier than me. I mean, I would say maybe more like, You see how, have you seen LL Cool J in that new show that he's in, or it's not so new anymore? Mm-mm. I don't want to liken myself to LL Cool J because that's maybe putting on airs, but.
Well, ladies do love cool Jesse.
Hey, what are you going to do?
Ladies love Goulding.
Ladies love Goulding. maybe something, I don't know. I mean, I look more football player-y than I do.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I was
defensive end.
I was benching. I was repping 245 mm-hmm. on the bench, 250 somewhere in there, which is a lot.
I don't think I've ever.
No. Sorry, I'm sorry. No, I was benching 345. Mm. I was benching.
What are you five?
Five, maybe nine.
5'9".
5'8" and some. 5'8" and change.
Mm.
Anyway, so yeah, I was very bulky, and yeah. He's like. Of course, he's like, you can't ride that frame. It's like, what are you talking about? I've been riding this for years. And he's like, well, that's why it broke.
Yeah.
this frame is not rated for someone over 200 pounds.
What did you get next?
I ended up getting a...
See, I never think about that. You think about frames, like, about for...
Right.
Well, they'll build sturdier frames for touring.
Right, I ended up just getting a mountain bike, which I still have. It's a... The funny Gary Fisher? Yeah, mm-hmm. I got a Gary Fisher.
Mm-hmm.
It was good. I mean, it's definitely, it wouldn't break under me, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. But, like, when I get on it now compared to, I mean, I don't know, bike technology has really gotten so much better. They're so much lighter and stronger now. I feel like my bike just weighs 1,000 pounds. I'd like to get a new frame.
Yeah. I mean, my steel bike is pretty light, and that thing was mm-hmm. made in the early 70s.
Yeah. Right, but it can support.
It was a racing frame,
right? Though. It can support you, though.
Yeah.
So, at a certain.
My bike is a Craigslist find, and it's an early '70s Nishiki mm-hmm. Pro frame,
right?
And I don't know a lot about bikes, but it does really? Have a Campagnolo group on.
How is it that you don't know enough about bikes?
Well, I would never. It's like when I talk about film. Like I feel like I'm. I fancy myself somewhat of a film buff, but if I go toe-to-toe with, like, somebody who really is a film buff...
Right.
Actually, as I get older, that's less and less true. My knowledge is pretty broad of film, right. But I still feel like I'm a dilettante.
Right.
Yeah.
Were we talking about the root of the word amateur?
No. I don't think so.
Anyway, I was talking to somebody, and I said something about...
It's French.
But it also has it's like to love... It's like the amateur is like a lover of.
Oh, and cool. That does sound familiar.
So,
in other words, somebody who's not doing it for money.
Right. Yeah, but weird. I always say, like, I don't know, I said, like, oh, it's amateur hour over here. And I meant it in a derogatory way, as in, like, we should be professionals, but we're.
Well, it normally is a pejorative.
It is normally a pejorative, but to think about it, like, he's an amateur. Whatever botanist is like not a pejorative, right? It's like to be like a dilettante botanist would be sort of a pejorative, right? It's an interesting word.
Dilettante is because dilettante implies maybe you're faking it,
or that you're you're doing it to be for the appearance's sake rather than a deep love of it, right?
Yeah.
So right. So it's like it's trendy to be whatever. Into collecting butterflies, but they don't really have a great love of collecting butterflies, whatever that means.
Maybe that's my friend Carolee is her zine. Oops, sorry. There's a meeting that I blew off today.
Can you please mute your phone?
All right, jeez.
Don't you hate that? Is one thing that another thing that bothers me
about podcasts
when the guests, like especially Vernon Reed, it seems like. Has some crazy.
Oh, thinker. He's got kids yelling in the bathroom.
Well, I don't mind kids yelling in the bathroom, but you can hear that like bloop 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 bloop. Has someone's
people
phone.
Have emails going?
Right. They're I guess they're Skyping, so it's hard to. Ignore
oh right,
the,
right. We should figure out things. How to Skype and record.
Yeah, maybe for sure.
Especially when you.
I don't know if that's going to happen. What are you doing?
Okay.
You blow me out on a podcast. I guess I have.
I think that we're going to have to break down some walls today because I have some stuff I want to talk about.
All right, let's talk about it. Let's get into it. Let's chop it up.
Yeah. So, so Jesse and I have not, we don't know if anybody's ever going to listen to these. It's kind of funny to say.
I think someone will.
But we, You know, rule number one of podcasting is that you keep to a regular schedule.
Yes.
So we've already fallen off that.
Right.
And it's so funny how that happens so quickly.
Busy it people. Is. Yes.
But, so Jesse and I have fallen off. We haven't done this in 3-4 weeks.
3 weeks. Only.
3 weeks.
Possibly two, though.
Maybe two. Let's say 2.5 weeks. Okay. That sounds right.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But, so today, in the past, we've tried to be pretty organized about it. Or at least Jesse has tried to impose some organization.
But then the surf got really good.
And the surf got really good. And
then I went to Hawaii.
And you went to Hawaii. Oh, what did I do? I went to New York to see my parents.
Right.
So we're kind of, today we're kind of out of necessity and also just an experiment being a little looser today with our conversation.
Less organized in terms of topics. But it sounds like you've got something you want to say.
Now I feel like I'm on the spot.
You're not on the spot.
No, I had some ideas and things I wanted to talk about. Mm-hmm. I've been having a hard time with teaching this week, to tell you the truth. Yeah, so I wanted to talk a little bit in a broader sense. I wanted to talk in a broad sense about failure.
Right. I saw that tweet you said the other day. Like, we talk about all the heroes, but what about the cowards?
Yeah. Speak for the cowards. That's very much in line with what I was thinking. Like, I was thinking about... Well, our podcast is called The Aphorists, and there's one aphorism that you hear quoted in different contexts that can be inspiring, but when I think about it, the more I think about it, the more it annoys me, and that is basically this idea to the effect of, failure. I'm sure I'll say this and you'll probably think of some cliche that's, but like failure is the best teacher.
Right.
Is that,
right.
That yeah. maybe even be it.
Yeah.
Failure is the best teacher. So
there may be a more succinct way of, I mean, I don't know, but yeah, failure is a great teacher.
Yeah. Artists will often talk about, don't be afraid to fail, or that's always instruction to like
safe place to make mistakes.
Right. Now, I guess, what bugs me about that, I think it's true to an extent, but, it's also, there's something false about it in that the person who's saying that is always somebody who ultimately succeeded.
Right.
Right? So, and I think about this in the context, because, you and I are both consumers of podcasts and interviews and... whether it's Fresh Air or WTF, the narrative of failure is always bookended by, or it's always bracketed by someone who ultimately succeeding. So I don't know. Can you just go out there and find somebody who just straight up failed? Just straight up find a failure. So, the narrative of failure, where failure is the end game, or where failure is the result, is sort of missing from the culture.
Saying is basically failure, but then a failure followed by repeated attempts. So there's failure and giving up, and then that person's just a failure. And then there's failure.
Not even giving up. What about people who fail and do it again and fail and do it again and just.
But
people that are terrible at something that just keep doing it.
Well, why do they? I mean, at some point they stop getting the opportunity to keep doing it, right?
I suppose.
I mean, failure. I mean, it implies two things. One, that you're putting yourself out there to do something, right? So it's in the public sphere, or it could be teaching or whatever it is. I mean, in a quasi private sphere, but it's not you're failing in a public way, right? You could fail in your own house and no one would look, you know what I mean? Like, there's probably a million.
You fail as a, private failures. Failures as a parent, as a lover, as a friend.
There's a millions of failures in that regard, right? So you're talking
as a handyman. As a member of your HOA board.
Exactly.
So although that's somewhat public.
Right. But when you're, so I think you're, are you talking more specifically about these sort of public failures?
Let me bring my, I'll bring in the coward analogy, which is, I love that you brought that up because it's exactly what I was thinking because like, all right, Barack Obama had this commercial late in the campaign, which was like this awesome piece of, you know, agitprop or whatever you want to call it. Or propaganda. Mm-hmm. It was like, for him, it was like, we're going through some hard times, but we've added so-and-so jobs to the economy.
Right.
Blah, blah, blah. You know, it's a big concrete improvements. And then it shows, like, some inspirational photos of, like, military people coming home, meeting their families, over, you know, Ken Burns effect with Obama saying over it. And our heroes are returning home from Iraq and Afghanistan. Like, so that's really smart, you know, to call people in the military heroes.
Right.
You know, especially if you're a Democrat.
Right.
Who, you know, a lot of people think is maybe a closet Muslim slash terrorist
right.
or whatever. But, like, you know, not everyone's a hero. Not everyone in the military is a hero.
Right. Well, they're just, like, we're just regular humans. I mean, they're just regular humans, right?
Or they humans? Or cowards.
Or cowards that do exceptional
plenty
things.
Plenty of cowards.
Yeah.
You know? And, like, seriously, who speaks for the cowards? So, like, this is another thing on Twitter, like, as a lot of people would say, my grandfather served in World War II. You know, just veterans. Shout out to veterans.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean to trash on veterans or anything,
right.
but
yeah.
I was visiting my parents week before last in upstate New York, and, like, and my dad, I mean, he maybe said this to me before, but I don't remember. And I actually tweeted this too, so you might have seen it.
Yeah.
But he was like, yeah, I joined the Navy in '53 because I didn't want to get my ass shot off in Korea.
Right.
So my dad's a veteran.
Yeah.
He's a is he a hero? I don't know. Like he,
yeah, that's a tough one.
He chose a safer.
Yeah, I mean,
you know, still a difficult thing to do, and something that was inherently risky too.
Yeah, totally.
But he chose a safer route.
I mean, he knew he was going to get called up one way or another, and so
I think he maybe had some insight into like new people on the draft board and knew that his number maybe was coming up, so he got a little heads up. But the Korea was not good.
Yeah, no, Korea
was not good. A lot of people died.
A lot of people died.
And sort of forgot, weird forgotten war.
Super weird forgotten war. Although what's interesting is like MASH 4077 basically was the Korean War, right? And so that was a very popular show, but...
But when MASH, the original movie, came out, it was implicit that it was a critique of Vietnam.
Right.
But it was, you know, using this device.
Right. But I think... I sort of feel like that has contributed to the sort of disconnect, and obviously we're both too young to really have an opinion about this, but the fact that it was sort of that it was using Korea to stand in for Vietnam sort of negated the Korean experience in some ways, I think.
Oh,
that makes sense. Like,
yeah,
it's like,
yeah,
oh,
yeah.
This is fictional, so nothing really happened in Korea because this is really about Vietnam.
Right, right.
It's kind of
curious. Yeah, interesting.
So anyway, but the...
I don't know. My point being, like, not every soldier is a hero.
Right.
You know, and... I don't know. Like, there's... is it our culture where, like... you know, just the narrative of failure is sort of missing.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes... It maybe speaks to, like, the sort of culture of positivity.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
I mean, it ties into the whole, like, extroverted...
And I'm saying this as a person who's pretty, like, has a lot of negative, like, thought patterns and lacking self-confidence. And
right.
Self-defeating.
Right.
Sort of, you know, cycles of thought.
Right. Interesting. Yeah, yeah. That's interesting. I mean, I think that there is definitely an emphasis on sort of, like, everyday heroism. And you think about... The shootings in the movie theater in Colorado. And there was that piece in Slate or in the Atlantic, I can't remember which one, they were talking about just like the women that had been saved by their boyfriends, brothers, whatever, husbands died, you know, that basically were like, you know, human shields, and protected their loved ones or strangers. And that they were talking about it as a sort of like male, both fantasy and impulse, and which comes first, the fantasy or the impulse to be the hero, that's something that's like embedded in our psyches and potentially the male psyche in particular. I'm not taking a position on that. I'm just talking about what this person wrote. Because I think sort of in a daily basis, if you see who is, you know, the mom, you know, like this mama grizzly, trope is like real, you know, like I think if you were to look at sort of the daily lives of people to see who's sacrificing,
I just hear that coming out of Sarah Palin.
Well, right, exactly. Yeah, totally.
Ridiculous bullshit.
Right. Yeah. Well, she's ridiculous bullshit, but I don't think that the trope itself is invalid.
Yeah,
but I do think that
fiercely protective mothers.
Right, right. But if you want to look at sort of like the daily lived lives of families and people in America, that there's, you know, who's making sacrifices, who's sort of living these quiet, heroic lives, I think it's like moms, mothers, like single mothers or, you know, working mothers, that there's like this sort of unappreciated.
Why does it have to be heroic, though?
Well, it doesn't have to be heroic. You're right. I guess but I think that we create a narrative about ourselves sort of in our daily lives. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so to frame to frame the struggle that is your daily life and as a sort of like hero's journey is a pretty compelling way to like get yourself out of bed and keep doing it day after day. Right.
I guess it seems a little over the top.
Yeah, right. You know, well, like, I'm not saying that.
Like, go back to the military example. Like, referring to military personnel as heroes. First of all, we have a professional military.
Mm-hmm.
We have had since you and I were born,
right?
Early 70s, when they did away with the draft, right? So there's no conscription, there's no draft. People choose to go in the military. Either out of an interest or like economic imperative, but we have a professional military. There's this sort of, in the whole like military personnel as heroes feeds this sort of, this militaristic narrative, jingoistic narrative,
right,
about how, you know, our country should exist in the world.
Mm-hmm. Like, are you taking a position that like just the fact that it's professional, like the profession being professional military sort of negates the ability, like the heroic description because they are employed to do this job, which they're doing?
I was saying the professional military creates this sort of disconnect. It's a different culture. It's a culture that's almost alien to, you know, sort of the mainstream culture.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we saw this in the Democratic Convention this year. There's sort of this, you know, just this, this lionizing of the military and people in the military.
Right. Both like David Petraeus.
Yeah. And it's not to say that like, you know, of course, I think like people should be honored for their service.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think
I don't agree with any of the wars that people are going to fight and die.
Yeah, but that said, they are doing pretty remarkable things as individuals and as a group. I mean, I have very sort of mixed feelings about the use of our military. But I would say that it's pretty remarkable in what they're capable of doing. And whether or not I consider them heroes, they are, they have some exceptional qualities based on the training they've received and the way they're able to operate.
No,
for
doubt,
sure.
No doubt.
So now, but I agree, you know, like, you know, is, but I also do think, like, you know, there are some, they do get into some pretty crazy situations and kind of rise to the, you know, those that are, when they're in these situations, rise to the occasion. It's pretty inspiring stories about, like, what, you know, what individual bravery and determination and willpower can achieve. Now, whether that they're a hero or not, I don't know. You know, that's an interesting question. I mean, I've certainly, certainly brave.
I think this lionization of the military is often used.
It's a recruitment tool.
It's a recruitment tool, but also as a political tool.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, the whole, like, if you oppose the war, you oppose the troops.
Right.
Which we saw in Iraq. Yeah.
Right.
Support the troops, support the war.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. No, And
I think a lot of people in the military have that mindset, like, these fuckers protesting the war.
Right.
You know, while we're over here.
Right.
And.
Yeah, that doesn't make any sense.
You know, I think a professional military is ultimately anti-democratic.
Huh.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. It's. We're essentially hiring a mercenary army, like, from our own ranks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think just from a democratic point of view, it's problematic. Look at, like, the ruling class in this country. I think if you look at Congress right now, there's maybe, like, one or two people who have, like, any military service in their record.
Mm-hmm.
It's because people that are privileged never have to experience that. You
right.
Know? So,
unless they go to officer, become officers.
Yeah. Yeah. But that happens less and less, you know? So, so you end up. The people that are
sort of
the military,
a norm, right, are more of a norm. You go to officer training school, then you'd, you know, once you have that under your belt, you'd become a politician or a whatever.
Yeah, I guess. You see that less and less, right? But yeah, definitely after World War II, like, a lot of military people went into politics. But mm-hmm. But I'm talking more about, like, it's become, it, like I said, it becomes the same thing that's alien to the mainstream. I'm kind of going to go off topic, my narrative of failure.
Right, right.
But
it's a curious thing. I mean, I think if we had to do a draft to field an army to go to Iraq or Afghanistan, that we wouldn't have gone, right? Because people would have just said, no, we're not doing this.
Right? Yeah. Well, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, it's good. That's a very interesting question.
A lot of people did join. After
9/11. Right. To go to, yeah.
And I think one among George Bush's many sins was that he exploited that, you know, that desire on people's part to contribute and do something in the wake of that tragedy to then send a bunch of them to fight a totally illegal, misguided war that had nothing to do with the attack that occurred here.
Yeah.
I mean, that, I still, like,
yeah.
When that was all happening,
right.
I still remember, I just thought I was losing my mind.
Yeah.
That was, I had, like, an entire country gone insane.
Yes. Yeah, no, I felt the same way.
Yeah.
So the cowards. So what would you, do you object to the, or you're just curious about, maybe object's not the right word, you're just curious about the emphasis on heroism and the sort of, and that anytime you talk about failure, you talk about failure as a learning moment that ultimately led to some great success, and that there isn't a lot of talk about sort of like, mediocrity or whatever.
Yeah, mediocrity.
Right.
Yeah.
But don't you think we just, we always, but I think we
always. Mediocrity is the default.
Right.
Is it okay to be mediocre?
Sure.
There's a place for it.
Yeah, I mean, it's everywhere.
That's true. It's hard to get excited about it.
Well, that's the thing. No one gets excited about mediocrity. It's just.
What's mediocrity, though? In this table, IKEA furniture, is that mediocrity?
Yeah, IKEA furniture is mediocrity.
Although there's things that are outstanding about it.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you know, I mean, I think it's sort of like, I feel like there's, my sister-in-law once said, after some, you know, sort of bizarre customer service experience, she said, you know, mediocrity is the new excellence, it seems like. And it's like that.
Yeah, it's people's expectations are just, decreased.
Sure. Right, because like all the things, it's sort of like in the face of American exceptionalism, all this, you know, we have this, and this goes into maybe, like, ties into the whole military power and all that stuff. But basically, you know, there is a belief that America's number one in all regards, and that, you know, our foreign policy is perfect, and that our children are the best educated and smartest and most innovative.
Really? Amongst who?
Well, I mean, that's the narrative that happens, you know, like, if you watch the news, listen to politicians talk, listen to, you know, there is no one saying, like, USA is number four, USA is number four, you know? It's USA is number one, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a total disconnect from what's really happening, right? It's sort of like what Hanna Rosin's talking about in The End of Men. There's this sort of, you know, it turns out that things have gotten hollowed out, right? And that there's just this shell, it's just a veneer of what used to be, and there's really no content within it, right? So our children aren't the smartest because they, you know, our school system, we haven't invested in our school system in the way that we used to.
Mm-hmm.
Our businesses aren't the most competitive because, you know, for a number of reasons, but, you know, just the free trade, you know, whatever, manufacturing going overseas, or also just the rise of India and China and Brazil and other places that are like competitive with us in a way that they just weren't before.
Mm-hmm.
But that we have this insistence that, you know, America's still the best, and, you know, across in some levels it probably still is. Whatever that means, but it's still a great place.
Well, it certainly has like, it has a lot of industry and it has a quality of life that
mm-hmm. is unparalleled.
Majority of people in the world would kill to right. have a pizza.
Right. So,
but I think it's also, it's an accident of history. Like mm-hmm. this is what bugs me about the whole notion of American exceptionalism. It's like, look, some Europeans like came to the US
mm-hmm.
or came to North America. They managed to, you know, get a hold of basically like an entire virgin continent,
mm-hmm.
you know, that was just teeming with resources.
Right.
And, you know, they managed to keep a republic, a large enough republic, you know, cohesive
mm-hmm.
for a long enough time to, you know, to be a really powerful economic force.
Right.
So there were a lot of just like sort of built-in advantages there.
Right. So while I think it's true that there were a lot of built-in economic advantages, but one of the things
you're pretending that, we didn't.
I'm pretending.
Just take a break for like half an hour.
Yeah, we okay. just took a break, but now we're back in it. So I think that, you know, one of the things that I was referencing earlier, I'm listening to this podcast called The Partially Examined Life, and they're doing an analysis of the Federalist Papers
mm-hmm.
and the struggle that the, you know, that the, basically the ratification of the Constitution and sort of the Federalist Papers are outlining all the possible arguments against creating a federal government and what federalism stands for and what the, so Hamilton, Madison, and Jay wrote these essays under a
And
under
the Federalists were like Tories.
I don't know what they were like, anything we're, else. I mean,
well, I mean, they were the more conservative faction and maybe the more loyalist faction.
Meaning to Europe?
Loyalist to the British model.
No,
the,
I don't think no? so at all. I mean, I don't know if they were more or less. I mean, they were all, I mean, part of the biggest worry among them was to make sure that their form of government stayed away from monarchy. The point that they're really breaking down in this podcast, The Partially Examined Life, is that and you know, if you read the Federalist Papers, but they're talking about the anti-federalists too, that, you know, they really struggled with coming up with a form of government that would have checks and balances on factions, or that individual branches of government couldn't or shouldn't outweigh. So basically you're saying, you know, we inherited this incredible natural resource, this land, this virgin land, but
they, not me.
Right.
My people were in Ireland.
Right, right. But we as Americans now came to, you know, you're talking about this natural advantage, which is true, but that, you know, there's plenty of places in the world that have tons of natural resources that don't have, that didn't organize themselves into a way that led to sort of productive use of that capital, maybe is the right, I mean, think about the, those advantages, like the amount of wildlife and fish and et cetera, wood, forests, those kinds of things, the natural resources, coal, et cetera, that, that led to a productive, you know, economy and political life didn't, you can have plenty of natural resources, but not have a sort of a productive economy. Right. And so there's something that is, I think,
white people.
No, I think that there's something in it, well, there's something about the
cultural.
It's cultural.
That's what Romney would say.
What's wrong with that?
I don't agree with it.
So what do you think about, like, Jared Diamond's arguments about
see the guns,
germs, and steels and the collapse?
I don't know that stuff well enough to talk
about. I mean, I don't know what Romney's saying at all, so your reference is lost on me totally.
Oh, well, he went to Israel, and he said that, look, here on the Israel side of the border, this place is teeming with commerce, and on the other side of the border, in right. Gaza... people live like animals.
Right.
I'm paraphrasing, but I think this is essentially how he thinks. What's the difference between the two? They're cultural differences.
It's hilarious. I mean, it's,
no,
it's not hilarious. They're, it's horrendously
right,
offensive.
It's horrible. Yeah, and no, there are built-in
right,
advantages,
right, right. Yeah,
and you know, like
it's an incredibly offensive statement.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't acknowledge the like. You know,
look,
bias against...
To say that I don't believe in American exceptionalism is not the same as saying that. I don't think that, like, the United States has the potential of being a positive force in the world. But mm-hmm. I do think that, like, there's some, maybe I can call it, like, national goal thinking going on there.
For sure.
Everybody thinks, like, where they are from is the most special place.
I don't think everybody thinks that
way. Not everybody thinks that way, but, like, that's the essence of, like, jingoism.
For sure, for sure. It's placism.
Yeah. And I think, like, just enlightened people should be on their guard against that. And calling our military heroes implies that our military is wearing white hats and they're wearing black hats.
And that everything that we do is... somehow virtuous, despite the fact
yes,
that we're like...
Yes, because heroes are doing it, and heroes right. don't do bad things.
Exactly. No, it's I completely agree with you that it's horrendous sort of myopia, maybe, or just willful ignorance at its worst, that we don't acknowledge the incredibly negative... sort of bad, whatever. I mean, it's hard. We create this narrative.
No apology. That was Romney's. That's Romney's book.
Is that right? Well, we create this sort of false dichotomy about good and evil when it's really just so much like it's obviously it's more complicated than that. Always, it's mm-hmm. never about good and evil. I mean, that's not never about good and evil. I mean, you can definitely say that there are some unalloyed evils historically, and but you know,
well,
like,
it'll
you
this
can say that like the drone attacks that where like a drone will hit a target and then people will rush in to go rescue whatever the survivors because it just happens in a you know in a village in Pakistan and then they hit it with another fucking bomb. Because they say anybody that's helping the terrorists that we just killed are also terrorists, right? When it's like that, the fact that we do that, the American government does that, is insane to me.
Mm-hmm.
That continues to happen. And yet, I can also say that, and the same government that does that does also lots of really great things. And so they don't discount each other, but... So to say, like, the American government is good or bad is not a, I don't feel like it's a particularly useful way of thinking about things. And that, you know, sort of rolls up into this idea of American exceptionalism. Right, the other, you know, side, I mean, it's of like the other side of the coin. Well, it's like, do you want, we'll go ahead, what's the other side of the
coin? Oh, well, like, you know, people on the left are getting accused of being like, blame America first or whatever.
Right.
You know, like, America can only do evil in the world.
Right.
I mean, that's like also wrongheaded, like, because there's a responsibility the United States has is
to do things, because we can't, we should. But yeah. I think, you know, it's like the, it's sort of, when we've talked about this before, about just sort of like the unintended consequences of actions, right? And so, like, Russ Roberts says, don't act because, you know, so like the, what are they called? Ron Paul. What's his? Libertarians are saying, like, don't do anything because, or let's just say Hayek says, don't, government shouldn't take any action because it's not going to do a good job of it. And it's probably going to make things worse. And which I say is like a position that you can't move out of, right? And so when should you act and who should act when it's clear that you need to? But this idea, this, I mean, I sort of see this American exceptionalism as a sort of unexamined way. But it's this sort of like unexamined way of acting, right? Of being. To say that we take as our basic premise that we're always doing good, and
God on our side.
That God's on our side, and we're, you know, westward ho, whatever. But it discounts.
Why are you gonna bring hoes into it? Boats and hoes.
But it's so I think it goes into your, into, you know, to your point about the sort of like making everybody out to be a hero that sort of moves your agenda forward, and. But you're right, and that's it. That's what you talk about. And every
we're holding out for a hero.
We need a hero,
and we don't need another hero.
We don't need another. You're saying we don't need another hero.
We don't need another hero.
Is that a song?
But we could be heroes.
We could be heroes
just for one day.
Remember that show, American Hero?
I just quoted three songs.
Do you remember that show, American Hero?
Yes,
it's so great.
Great American Hero.
Great American Hero.
Robert Culp, and what's his face?
I like the way he portrayed learning to fly. Great.
never really mastered it.
he
was always flailing his arms.
Just flailing his arms and going like 3 feet above the ground and crashing into shit. It was perfect. Who wants to talk about, like, what newscast would talk about the sort of average, the everyday, whatever person that, like me or you, that goes to your job and doesn't do anything exceptional. But
no, I'm not.
Is that what you're saying? It's not what you're saying.
I'm not saying the news shouldn't report on, you know, things of consequence. I'm saying, like, I would like to hear interviews. Maybe the Afros can do this. I would like to hear interviews of people that do unremarkable things.
Right on. Just like not dying.
Yeah. Just like in Fresh Air, like, not dying. Or whatever. Just like, you know. I wouldn't want it in the context of like.
You were competent today?
Well, let me put it. Like, I think it's just, you're just missing a big part of the narrative, I guess. And you just focus on people that have achieved success.
Mm-hmm.
Put it that way.
I mean, you know, I think we
and failure isn't always instructive.
Failure can be incredibly painful, and can stop you.
Yeah,
and it right.
Fear of failure.
Yeah, but you know, I mean, people feel like people stand in, people are their own worst enemy, right? They stand in their own way. They, you know, you don't.
We're talking about me right now, right?
Yeah, we're absolutely talking about you right now, right? You don't achieve your dreams because you think. You're not worthy.
Why bother?
Why bother?
I'll just fail anyway.
Right. You're going to fail and no one's going to care.
Mm-hmm.
You're not
going to. And everyone will find out I'm a fraud.
Totally.
That I don't belong here.
Absolutely. That's incredibly painful.
And everyone around me is competent and,
and you're
on the ball.
You're mediocre.
Yeah.
If you'd be lucky to achieve mediocrity.
Yeah. Yeah. Basically.
Absolutely. So let's talk about your teaching. What's the teaching experience that led you to this epiphany?
Oh, it's not an epiphany.
Or your new aphorism.
Oh,
failure isn't.
Nothing. I would say, okay, here's my aphorism. Nothing fails like failure. I don't think that's. I think people have already.
That's a tautology.
Also, I think people have already said that.
Is that right? Yeah.
Yeah. No, I'm just having a hard time with this drawing class. I'm teaching this drawing to class.
And the, is it the student's reaction to you? What is it? What's the problem? Or is it more complicated?
It's at a very hard point because like, there's a number of factors. I got the job at the last minute. Actually, in the second week of school, they gave me this class. I've never taught a drawing class before.
Right.
I've taught tons, so I do have a lot of experience teaching. But I've never, and I've taken a lot of drawing classes. Mm-hmm. I've never taught a drawing class. So, anyway, those two things. And I feel objectively, the class is not that bad. They're talented students. I knew from the get-go they're really quiet.
Mm-hmm.
And like, they give nothing back.
Right.
Like, and that's always hard with any class.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. It's just like, you know, teaching a class the way I don't want to teach a class, which is like doing everything at the last minute. I never felt caught up.
Mm-hmm.
Was always coming up with assignments at the last minute and not able to test them.
Right.
I mean, so on the one hand, and I do believe that this is a great learning experience, you know, like, and, but like, you know, I think the mistakes I made were like not structuring the class enough because they're just not at a point where they can work independently. And I modeled, another professor gave me a, the syllabus, actually the chair gave me the syllabus. I couldn't name people here. She had taught the class before, a few years before, and she based it on a show, a drawing show, Drawing Now. Was that New York MoMA in 2002? Right. It's a great idea. So it was like, you treat these different propositions. It's called Drawing Now, 8 Propositions. So like, the show was structured curatorially, and these different, like, these people are working in this way. So it was like, it was a way of couching these different techniques in sort of a conceptual framework.
Right.
And so, and she was like, yeah, I structured everything. So I said, well, I'll model it after how she taught the class because I know I've taken classes with this person. And I'm like, I know how she wants class to be taught. And she's basically like, yeah, they read the propositions, we looked at examples, and then we had discussion and we did studies based on like techniques that were used in the work. It's like, okay, I can do, yeah, that sounds good. And then they would do like an independent project based on the idea.
Right.
All sounds good, unless you have students who are not prepared to work independently.
Right.
Which these students largely aren't. Some of them are. A handful of them are.
Is it? Have you had, in like printmaking classes, have you had that same situation where, and you've been able
to overcome it? No, because in printmaking, I have taught printmaking, and I mostly teach intro to printmaking. Mm-hmm. I've taught very few like upper division printmaking courses where students work more independently. So typically, my classes are highly structured.
Right.
So
was it expectation that these students would be able to work independently and they just
weren't? That was my expectation. It turned out, no, they largely aren't.
Okay.
And maybe I realized that too little too late. And I kept trying to do the same approach over and over again.
And it, right.
Rather than trying to figure it out again.
And so it's curious, it's like if you had been in a situation where you were more comfortable with the material, you might have recognized that sooner.
Yeah, and been able to be more flexible.
Right. You know, it's funny though. I was thinking about this the other day. What was that? In my own practice, I came to a realization, and I was like, "Well, why didn't I do this sooner? Like, it seems so obvious now. Like, if I could redo what I did, I would, you know, fix X, Y, and Z." And then I was like, "Oh, but I mean,
you weren't at that point yet.
I'm only able to see that now. Like in retrospect, you know, weeks later, you know, and it's." It's one of those things where you sort of, like I had this moment I was like sort of beating myself up about missing that opportunity or like making it harder on myself. And then I realized like, oh, but I had to have gone through that experience in order to recognize it there's a better way to do it.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And it's sort of like the same thing.
You know, it's funny.
Just that you're even, I feel like it's a positive that you're even keyed in the first place to recognize
that it's not working.
That it's not working, you know?
Well, you know, it's, I keep thinking it's ironic. I had a hard week with them this week because this assignment, first of all, I taught an assignment. So one proposition is about, it's called drafting an architecture, and it's talking about like artists using like technical means of drawing, mm-hmm. you know, using them in a art context, basically.
Right.
So I studied up on some perspectival drawing techniques, and like I actually use like isometric projection,
mm-hmm.
Which I think is really cool. It's basically a way of like taking a plan view and elevation and putting it into this three-dimensional model where there's
right.
it's a weird kind of space where there's no foreshortening.
Right.
It's looking like a video game space. So I like made this whole slideshow like. You know, all, like, artists who use isometric projection. You know, mm-hmm. If you look at Escher, you know.
Right.
I mentioned, like, pictures of, like, SimCity,
mm-hmm.
you know, and just video game spaces like that. And some of the artists in the section use isometric projection,
mm-hmm.
you know. And that actually went well. That first day went well. Some of them were really challenged with it. So, like, the second class rolled around, and the ones that really challenged, I was like, I'm going to demonstrate this for you guys again, because you guys aren't getting it. And in the meantime, I wanted to introduce this other way of putting taking a plan view and elevation, putting it into classic two-point linear perspective,
mm-hmm.
which, frankly, I did not have a handle on.
Right.
And so, like, I spent, like, the first half of the class trying to get a bunch of people up to speed, and then I'm like... And then I had some students who had gotten the first lesson, and they were just like, I thought you were going to demo this other thing for us. What's going on here?
Right.
And they're, like, bored. And I just, like I said, I didn't really – that. So I did this, like, just terrible demonstration
mm-hmm.
of it where I did actually, like, full-on fucked up one part of it up.
Really?
Like, all these steps, you know, and, like – and they were – It was horrible.
Yeah.
It was horrible.
Yeah.
I was so depressed after that. And I was just like, yeah, so. That was two classes ago. And then the last class was good. I had a visiting artist, actually, this guy,
mm-hmm.
Gabe, that I worked with at the Berkeley Art Museum. He came in. And that was great. But again, you get so little from these students. I have no idea.
Right.
Like. Dude, I like in an effort to do like discussions with them. Like, I give them a reading,
mm-hmm.
and we're supposed to have discussions, and it's just like
crickets.
Yeah, I'll read a paragraph and be like,
Bueller.
Yeah, what do you think of that? And then just like, I don't know, it's that thing where like some people are afraid to talk first,
right?
Bizarre. To where, like, you know, the next time I did just... This is why I kept trying to tweak the model that I started with.
So, right.
Like,
right.
I, like, the next section, like, I spent so much time. Oh, my God. I took apart the reading. I assigned different parts of it to groups of two students. Said, you guys are going to research this part. You research this footnote.
Right.
You look up this word. Tell us what it means.
Right.
You know, half of them didn't do it.
Right.
You know, you're like, I gave you the link
right.
to the article that was footnoted.
Right.
Like, I freaking, it's there in black and white.
Right.
Didn't do it.
Right.
Couldn't be bothered. Like, this is so boring to me.
Why are they, is it a required class?
It's drawing too. It's required for the major.
So they're ostensibly majors?
Painting major. Yeah, they're supposed to be.
Huh.
And they've taken drawing one. So... You can make no assumption that they're sort of that they have any interest in what you're presenting.
Right.
Like, it's just been real. It's just been a struggle. So I gave out a handout that I basically copied from someone else. It was a handout on colored pencil technique.
Right.
It was just like, because we did a whole section on colored pencil.
Right.
And this is what I really love about teaching. So I'm like using colored pencil.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm even. You know, just drawing with that at home and stuff. Kind of deconstructing these techniques. And,
right.
So it's this handout, and it talks about different materials that you can use.
Mm-hmm.
But I gave them a separate materials list that was much more bare bones.
Right.
This is just talking about, like, this is like a primer and color pencil.
Right.
I don't know. And now I gave them I gave them their final project, which is like 2 weeks of them working independently. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, they can't work independently. Right. So it's just going to be
a nightmare.
I'm just going to dread it every day.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be like watching the clock during class.
Yeah.
It's like that horrible thing where you're in this track where it's too late to change.
Yeah.
It's too late to change this class. It's the fucking train wreck.
It seems like it was really a drawing one class. You had drawing one students for a drawing two class.
I should have taught drawing one.
Yeah.
Cool thing is, I'm actually teaching a drawing one class at DBC.
Right.
In the spring. And DBC, one thing they do is they have very... And yet, well, so I'm struggling with, like, failure right now. I'm, like, struggling with, like, you know, just all the facets of failure.
Yeah.
Like, the just fear of, like, you know, in an academia, you sort of, or at least, it's sort of this paranoid environment.
Yeah.
Not, like, states like this. States right, is not right. like this, but, like, are the students, you know... Are the other instructors or the chair talking to students about my class? Are they, like,
right.
shitting on my class to other students and other teachers?
Right.
Because I hear them do that in my classes.
Right.
You know, like, paranoia kicks in. Mm-hmm. It's like, and just, like, I should know this. I know how to teach. I should have, you know, I should have spent more time on it. I should have, you know, I have spent tremendous amount of time.
Yeah.
I should be better at using my time.
Right.
Or whatever. It's just like every, you know, just those every...
everything every you're going to be down. Every, you yeah. You're
yourself into relief.
You're sort of, yeah.
And
but it's funny, though, that you don't think, like, everything you're talking about, it seems like you'll... This is a sort of, like, learning experience for you.
Though, oh, absolutely.
You know? So it's like your own... I mean, you're going to continue to teach. I think this is going to make you even a better teacher than you already
were. Oh, absolutely.
And so it is, you know, this is a failure as an opportunity or a failure as a teacher. And,
yeah.
And not just failure as
I hope so.
Being a failure. I mean, clearly you're a good teacher. You know, I think every teacher has that experience of a class where they're just like, holy shit, where did these kids come from? Like, what is it about?
I don't want to put it all on them, though.
No. Obviously.
But,
you got to meet their halfway. You know what I mean? And like,
well, that's the thing.
They got to meet you, and you got to meet them, right? So, like, maybe the thing that you, like, if you could change one thing, would it be that you would have recognized that they can't work independently? Would you, you know, like, there are certain things that you were just like not in control of, right? You got the class 2 weeks in, and you've not taught drawing two before. Now, maybe you should have said, like, one response is, I really don't think you want me to teach that class. Is there somebody else that you can get to teach it? Clearly.
I was not going to say that.
No, of course not. So it's like you want the opportunity.
It's not an option.
Yeah, right. So then it's sort of like, so that take that off the table, right? So it's like you're going to do – now, you worked really hard on getting it set up, and the chair helped you out, and, you know, you got dialed in. You just, you know, maybe they sense that you weren't as comfortable as you would be, like if you were teaching a silk screening class or whatever, that, so there was like a somewhat of a lack of confidence that, that they sensed and sort of made them doubt you, you know what I mean? So maybe that set it off on the wrong foot or something like that, but who knows? But I think, you know, you get
what do you mean?
Meaning like,
the students recognize
if the students recognize that,
yeah, that could be,
then they might not take it as, you know, it's like, well, who's this guy to teach us? We don't know. Like, we have a friend who was teaching an art history class for the first time and sort of under similar circumstances. And he just basically had to stay one chapter ahead of the students.
Yeah.
And, you know, he developed, you know, when someone would ask, he'd say, well, we'll get into that next week.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, he just didn't know the answer as well as he could have if he had taught, you know, and then he taught it again the next semester and everything was fine. Right.
Right. Right. And,
but it's sort of like, you know, to be a good teacher, you don't have to be an expert. Right. In the material, right? And so I think, you know, you probably did your level best, but that there was a disconnect between you and the students this time, and that it does sound like, you know, despite whatever attempts, and you've tried a lot of things in order to get them engaged, right? You've tried mixing it up a bunch of times. The strategies that you've been successful with in other classes weren't successful in this class, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's like, you know, you had to come back with a new bag of tricks every time. And there's something about the inconsistency of that. But it's sort of like, how do you say to the students, you know, why aren't you guys engaging? That's a question you can't really ask, right? You have to just figure out a way to get them engaged. And if they're not,
or to shame them. I've been in classes where that was done.
Right, right.
It's not my style.
No.
Yeah.
But I mean, I've had, you know, I mean, I remember when we were taking Maria Michaela's class, when we were getting our MFA, did you take that history of, anyway, she,
what was it?
It ended up being a history of German art.
Mm-hmm.
It was a great class. She's a really wonderful teacher. And, she was sort of like, hey, you know, you guys need to participate a little bit more. You know, it was this big lecture hall, you know, and
it was undergrad.
There was undergrads and grads.
Yeah.
So, but you know, grads are required to take an art history class or two or whatever the requirement was. So a bunch of us were in that. And, you know, she figured out a way to like get people, you know, once we just started talking and then she kind of couldn't get us to shut up. I mean, the whole class, it wasn't just the grads, it was the undergrads as well. And, you know, it's just like, but it took her a couple classes in order to figure out a way to get us to talk. And I don't know what it was that she did, but she was struggling to get us going. And then by the end of the class, she said, you know, I've taught at Stanford and I've taught, you know, here and there. And you guys were the best, you know, this has been the most engaged class that I've ever taught.
Yeah.
And so it's, you know, it's hard to know, like, what got her momentum going. I don't know. You know?
Yeah.
I was in it, you know. And there was a... you know, there's a couple of that, you know, I think about it, you know, in retrospect, there was something about her sort of deep expertise that made you want to not say anything because it's just sort of like, oh, I don't have anything to contribute. Like,
oh,
you've got
this
figured out, you know? But then, you know, you sort of realize, oh no, she really, I mean, even if she does, you can have your own theories that are legitimate or whatever, or ask questions that are instructive, you know, what, or illuminating about the material in a way that it wasn't before. So it just, she figured out a way to get us to participate, but it's hard to overcome that. Especially in certain kinds of settings, you know? So.
Well, Sarah told me something very telling this week, which was, I asked her if she would come show her prints to my print one class.
Uh-huh.
Sarah, my wife. And she makes these amazing etchings.
Yeah.
She doesn't want to do it. She doesn't want to do it. And I finally was like, you know, I was kind of joking, but I was like, you know, you'll show your stuff to other classes. Why won't you come to my class?
Uh-huh.
And she was like, I don't want to be speaking while you're there. And she said, because you're really smart and you're really critical.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
And I was just like, I'm an asshole.
You're not an asshole.
That just means I'm an asshole.
Right.
My own wife...
But I could see that wanting to I mean,
yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, yeah. I don't see it like that. I mean, I could.
I don't see myself as intimidating in the least.
Right.
But I think
you have a strong opinion. I mean, that's one of the things that I've always enjoyed speaking with you about. Like, one of the reasons that I enjoy having conversations with you is that, you know, you definitely have a strong point of view about things.
Mm-hmm.
And I often feel like I don't. And now, obviously, I do. But I feel like I can that I change my mind about things a fair amount. Mm-hmm. Or I change my perspective on things a fair amount. And so I feel like I'm a lot more plastic or elastic, whatever the right word is, in my point of view.
Mm.
And sometimes, like, to my detriment, I think. Mm. But I appreciate your strong opinions about things. But having given a lecture and, having shown my work and talked in your class, I mean, it was you're totally welcoming. And I felt like I liked the way you interact with the students. And I felt like, you could be a hard ass when you needed to be, but you were also, but for the most part, it was just like, seemed like your students really wanted to please you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a hard thing to do in an adjunct situation, I think, especially an adjunct situation. And I was impressed by that.
Mm-hmm.
So now I could also see Sarah not wanting to do it. Just because it's like that weird, well, there's like a separation of church and state, you know what I mean? Like, I don't really want to go to Amanda's workplace. That would be her, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, but you're not a lawyer.
No, I know, but
if you were a lawyer, would you do a presentation at her firm?
I don't think so. I don't know. Yeah. It just seems like that's her world and this is my world. I don't know.
Interesting. Okay.
So, I mean, I think it is. Artist couples are always, to me, they're strange, you know? Like, there's that.
It's hard. It's
definitely hard. And I mean, there's good and bad about it, right?
I think I've told you this before, like, Sarah. I think, like, we've struggled with her feeling like I don't respect what she does enough. I feel like that's an assumption on her part.
Right.
She's really bothered because, like, when she shows me stuff, I'll make suggestions that are, like, just totally upending how she approaches everything. Things.
Right.
Yeah. Like, it's not useful to her.
Right.
But that's the way I think about mine.
Right.
I want to know what's over the horizon kind of thing.
Well, you guys have very different approaches to your work, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think that's the tough thing about being in a relationship with an artist. I mean, Amanda and I, Amanda will listen to me talk about my work, but she's just sort of like, shrugs her shoulders at some point. She's like, okay, like, that was an interesting half an hour sort of like circuitous rant about whatever I'm thinking
she's
about,
the rational, lawyerly mind?
I don't even know if it's necessarily rational. She's just sort of like, I don't see the world like you see it, So...
Not like what you're saying is utter nonsense.
No. She didn't say what I'm saying is nonsense. She's just saying, like, okay, like, I can't participate in this conversation, but I've grown into the role of the sounding board for you.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? And so I say, okay, hey, I'm struggling with this idea. Can I just talk it out? And, I mean, I don't say it like, so I'm thinking about X, Y, and Z, and I'm really confused about how, should I make this, should I make that, is this conceptually rigorous, is this, like, in line with what I've been doing, is it crazy for me to think this, and then she'll say, well, why are you saying that, and she sort of draws me out a little bit. She's, good at having that conversation with me. I think by now she recognizes what I'm doing and what I need, and so we talk it out, and she's like, okay, but, like, you could ask her half an hour later, what did Jesse just decide, and she'd be like, I have no fucking idea.
Right.
She's incredibly supportive.
She can be a good sounding board, but she's not necessarily engaged.
She's not engaged. Yeah. She's just like, I'm glad that you're engaged. I'm glad this is what you're thinking about. I support it. It seems like interesting to you. But if you were to say, like, what's your husband's work about? I don't know that she would say, be able to, she could describe what I do, but I don't know that she would necessarily say, or even be interested in talking about that. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And which is legit. Like, I don't feel, I feel nothing but supported by her in that. I feel like I can explain what she does as a lawyer, but, again, I don't have the passion for it that she does, but it is interesting, and we know of a number of, people who are married or in relationships that are artists, and that works, and it doesn't work. you know?
Yeah.
So, because you and Sarah do have very different approaches to how you do things, even despite the fact that you make, you know, that you both have at times made very traditional prints, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So. But so she wouldn't give it, yeah, so.
But I feel like I've helped her. I think we've both helped each other. Like, I think she has helped me maybe more as a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Because she is just a better technical printmaker than I am.
Mm-hmm.
So she's helped me value those aspects more.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I've helped her broaden, like, this series of drawings she's doing now.
Oh, the gas stations that you went and took the drive.
Oh, the rest stops. Yeah. Like, that's something I think that I kind of helped. I think that came out of her experience of my going to grad school and sort mm-hmm. of issues that I was
dealing
working with. Through and yeah. the interest that I had.
Right.
I think it helped her sort of expand her
mm-hmm.
view of what her work could be.
Yeah, that's cool.
I think like her approach helped me value refinement more mm-hmm. than what I do.
Right, which has been a good thing in your work.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah, I think so too.
Yeah.
This is interesting. But anyway, yeah, so two more weeks with these kids. That's
really yeah. Fun. It's over soon.
12 hours.
Yeah.
I hate to think that way. It's awful.
But you know, it can't be, I mean, you've been very lucky so far, I'd say. You know what I mean? I think we have plenty of friends who teach that have had, like, horror stories.
Yeah, no, you're right. You know, you're right.
It's just sort of like,
and I have two at the Academy.
Yeah, for sure.
Just yeah. a horrible. Like, I remember, like, the thing that made me finally just stop teaching there was that two semesters in a row, I have students in the final critique just act like total assholes.
Mm-hmm.
I had this one girl who, like, made this book up, and it was like, she printed it on paper that was too small. It went off the page. It was like, bleed right. print. You know, I was like, did you intend that? Initially, I thought maybe she did. She's like, no, that's the biggest piece of paper I had. I was like, well, that's... And I just, you know, just... That's not a good answer.
Right.
You know, like, you need to consider that.
Right.
If it's a question of materials... Sorry. If it's a question of materials, you know, you need to prioritize as a student getting the appropriate materials. It's part of what we're right. doing here. And she said, look, I'm broke. What am I supposed to do? Whore myself?
Oh, wow.
And like,
no, I was like, no what? Person, what? There's certainly a middle it ground between.
Threw me off, like, freaked me the fuck out.
What did you say to that?
Nothing.
There's a difference. But you don't have to. I'm not in.
We went to the next student. You know, it was like incredibly. Okay? I think she may have even said that. You know, like, and I was like,
wow.
Like, I.
There's a middle sorry, ground between.
You know, like, I have a hard time being critical as a teacher. Uh-huh. Apparently people think that I'm very critical, but I actually struggle with that. Like, mm-hmm. I try not to be a cheerleader, and.
Right.
I'm not. But I also don't relate to being a hard ass,
mm-hmm.
but I am capable of being critical. So it's like, fucking paying me as a teacher to be critical here.
Right.
Like, you know, like, you're, whatever, students don't really put that together. But anyway, that was just like, and then the next one, like, I had a student who, I don't know what the hell his problem is, but he like stormed out of the final critique.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's just like, I can't deal with these students anymore. I just yeah. can't.
Too entitled or?
Just like not socialized.
Right.
I don't know. Like, and I have not had that experience with state students mm-hmm. or my community college students.
You know, it's funny because like.
Or my high school students in that, right. for that matter.
It's curious, like at state, it feels like the students are there and they kind of recognize where they're at, you know?
Yeah.
And also a lot of them have jobs and, you know, I mean, it's a school that's sort of set up in some ways for working people to get education. Yeah. And I don't know about...
I like that about it.
Yeah, me too. I mean, that's one of the things that I find very attractive about it. And that, you know, there's... You kind of recognize where you're at and what you, you know, that what you need to bring.
Yeah.
Right? You need to make the most out of it. And that... It's basically it's personal responsibility, right?
Yeah, yeah.
As opposed to just being like, I'm an empty cup, fill me up, right?
Yeah.
Your job is to fill me up.
Mm-hmm. And why do you fill me up?
You're so musical today. musical, air quotes.
Let's do karaoke. Well, the next one should be karaoke.
Next one will be all karaoke all the time. But you know, I mean, I think that there's, I mean, I see that all the time, and you know, in these kids, you know, in the 20s, these millennials,
these damn millennials,
the millennials. If they're, I don't know, they're different. I think they're a little bit slower. There's actually a book that came
very,
out.
I don't like to make these generalizations.
You don't? Okay.
No,
I was just listening to a June Thomas review a book written by a mother and daughter about the millennials, and they found out that, you know, they did a lot of research and, you know, the things that the baby boomers' parents were saying about the baby boomers.
Everyone's saying about millennials. Yeah.
But that there are some...
Only about the baby boomers, it really was true.
And then the
they were, like, born into unprecedented...
Right.
Affluence and privilege
totally.
And took it all for granted and then freaking used it up before anybody else could
get it.
So there was nothing less for anybody else.
That's right. For the millennials.
Yeah.
But they were saying that...
Who are we? We're not even... Are we Gen X?
Or Gen X, I think.
We're younger than Gen X, though.
Are we? Are we Gen Y?
We, like, fall through a demographic crack, I think.
Huh. Crack. That's why we're so awesome as a generation. Because no one's been saying shit about us that we have to internalize.
Well, when does the baby boomer end? 61, I think?
I don't know. Yeah.
That's right.
Anyway, they were saying that there were some, like, developmental milestones that the millennials were just hitting later. And they had a couple reasons for it, but it was interesting. So it's basically that they didn't have to, like, grow up and sort of be independent in the same way that other generations have. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know if that's true or what, you know what I mean? Like,
that's crazy.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of research that talks about, like, the you know, the folks that were the people in their early 20s who have this sort of general feeling of, you know, mild depression, a feeling that they aren't achieving, that happiness is just outside of their reach, that they've never been challenged and they don't know what they want. Everything's sort of, like, come easy to them. Everything they've done has gotten a gold trophy. And that there's sort of like this, you know, this stasis, like this emotional plateau that doesn't ever, there's no ups and downs, and that there's sort of like, there's nothing really to complain about. But
there are not a lot of opportunities in society.
Well, I don't even know if it comes necessarily to opportunities, but just talking about their general sense of self-fulfillment, that there's this, you know, they've gotten this, they've gotten that, they went to the school, they did the well, they had the A's, but that there's a sort of like unsatisfied sort of emotional state that they can't really name, and they think of their parents as their best friends, and they... you know, they just, they're not differentiated.
I can't relate to that.
I can't either. I mean, I love my parents, but it's just like the second I could get out of the house, I did, you know? So.
I was just thinking today about, like, you know, just thinking about, like, being, that feeling of being embarrassed. This is more like in high school, being embarrassed of your parents.
Right.
Like, there's my parents.
Let me go die.
Together.
Right.
You know, and like, that's, like, so fucked up. Like, these people, like, had this child who's, like, you know, achieving things. Uh-huh. And there they are still together, you know, with their child.
Yeah.
And, like, why does the child have to feel scorned towards that?
Yeah.
It's so strange.
It is strange. Well, I mean, it's part of the separation. No, it's not strange. I think it's a natural development. I say
because you have to
differentiate yourself from your parents.
Yeah,
you
know? Yeah.
And I actually think not being embarrassed by your parents is weird. You know what I mean? That seems developmentally.
No, you've seen that skit on SNL, right?
Which one?
It's Nasreen.
Her mom's like her. Yeah, yeah. Her mom's like her hero. She always wants to go to the parties and like. Her parents are really trying to get her to differentiate from them, and they're like,
"Yeah,
I wish to talk to my old gal pal, my old mom."
Alec Baldwin's playing her dad.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like at the cookout for her birthday party. And she's like hanging out with him instead of her friends.
Right, exactly. He's trying to encourage her.
Look at me. I'm wearing like.
I've always admired your sensible shoes, Dad. Yeah, like,
what? Polo with Bermudas. It's a classic look.
You're cutting edge. Totally, totally.
It's a classic, Dad. You're awesome.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. But she's that. Right, right. That's a real thing, I think. I mean, obviously, but I don't know. I mean, I think it has implications when how they are in the world, you know? And I've talked to, like... teacher, he takes these kids to Australia, and he talks about how like some of them are just like swimming in the. Maybe we'll have to remove his name from this, but he talked about a student who went swimming in the Great Barrier Reef and had a really great time, and then like he noticed that she wasn't going in the water for the next couple of days. And so on the day three of their 7 days there, he said, "So why aren't you going in the water?" And she said, "Oh, the salt water kind of messes with my hair. Makes my hair really dry." And he's like, "What? Like, the Great Barrier Reef is potentially not forever here. You know, like, this may be the only time that you get to see it, and you're one of the few people that is getting to see it. And... did you enjoy yourself when you were snorkeling?" And, you know, the answer was yeah. And he's like, "Well, you know, your hair is going to be fine. You know, like, what are you talking about? Like, that's just preposterous, right? It's like, that blows me away. You know what I mean? I don't have the words to describe the mindset of someone whose dry split ends would prevent them from seeing, like, this natural wonder. I don't know. What do you think? What's your response to that?
I know what it means to shut yourself off to amazing things.
Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yeah. To not be open to something amazing. I feel like I've done it. I've caught myself doing it myself.
Huh. Interesting.
So I think like, you know, especially teenage girl.
Mm-hmm.
I could see that.
You could see it.
I mean, like in 2 or 3 years, she'll probably look back and be like, "What the fuck was I thinking?"
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's the other thing about teaching, like, in college. Like, there's just every day for those people, for those kids, it's like that, right?
Yeah.
I mean, don't
yeah.
you think, like, every day is a moment where they're like, "Oh, shit."
See, I got to be able to, like, and I feel like I have given them a lot of great experiences, but you can't rely on them to be able to appreciate that.
Right.
As like... you have to run them through their paces.
So that's just like a nice way to close up the conversation to say that, you know, think of all of the, I mean, I still think back painfully to the my failures as a teenager or as a college student or as a whatever, you know what I mean? And, you know, I think I have compassion for myself at that time. So I try not to get too cringy, right?
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, yeah, I behaved badly in that moment. But I was 21 or 18 or 16 or 40, you know, whatever, or 30.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think about that moment and I think about, like, what was happening emotionally at the time. And then when I find myself in situations now where those similar feelings are triggered, I say, like, oh, okay, so I have a choice now to behave differently than I did when I was however old when that happened.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, that's a failure that I'm like, going, okay, I'm not gonna, and you know, obviously you fail a lot, you know, as a personality, you know, you fail a lot with behavior, and that's, you know, and hopefully you can break out of the cycle of those responses and
Well, I think there you go. I think there's a, you know, there's a pathology in my thinking that this kind of experience feeds.
But you do build on your failures. I mean, I see it in your studio.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
I do.
And I think, well, if, I mean, you, it's painful work, but it's important. And I think, you know, I mean, at least in your artistic practice, I can see the benefits of it. And, you know, as a person too. I mean, So, I guess, but, you know, it's also funny to think about, like, you know, you're, how do you have compassion for these kids in this class that are making it, you know? I guess that's your challenge, right?
Oh, well, you know, I don't blame them. Right. I seriously, I'd put it all on me.
Okay. Well, then have some compassion for yourself. You got to have some compassion for yourself.
I think, like, it's your job as a teacher to break through that.
But if you're, you know, and I also think, like, and this happens in so many aspects of your life or my life, but, like, the sort of tenser I get around succeeding or a certain outcome, the worse it is. The harder it is to achieve, right? The harder you think about something, the less well it goes.
Right.
And so I think, you know, and I'm curious, like, your desire to teach a really good class and you're coming so late in the game to teaching that class put you in a sort of like state that was really, you know, you were in that trough that's really hard to get out of. And then, you know, you got no push from the students, right? So that makes it doubly hard. And then, so like, because you want this to be a good experience for them, which is what makes you a good teacher, frankly, or one of the things, I think, then, you know, it's like you want to, you know, every class is like, okay, I'm going to get them this time. This class is going to be a success. And I'll undo the...
There are plenty where I just go in like, nope, this is not going to go well. This is going to be a long 3 hours. I'm
very sorry, Anthony.
That's on the next 3 weeks we're going to be, dude.
Maybe you find a way to turn it around, man.
I will. Actually, Dan Lake's going to come out and, and critique their work.
That'll be interesting. See how they respond to it.
Yeah, someone else. Yeah. Maybe he'll pull them out of there. Or else he and I will stand next to each other while they're...
Right.
Like, looking talking at to each other while they're just...
Right. Maybe they all have Asperger's.
Maybe.
You just have to, you happen to get the class of it. All right, should we wrap it up?
Sure, you don't want to talk about cognitive behavioral therapy.
Maybe next time. Next time we'll be talking about cognitive behavioral therapy. Unless you need some right now.
I do. I'm gonna lay down on the couch.
Tell me about your mother.
Okay, yeah. Let's do it. Let's get this thing online so people can
hear it.
Listen to it.
All right. This week.
All right.
You've been listening to The Aphorists. Failure is not an option.
Failure is not an option.
All right.
Nothing fails like failure.
Nothing fails like failure. All right.